from KQED.
Howdy doody, everybody. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. And back from my international reporting trip, I'm Scott Schaefer, politics editor here at KQED.
I'm Marisa Lagos, politics reporter here. We are very happy to have you back, Scott. We can't wait
to see
you.
Was I missed?
You were missed, and we can't wait to see that reporting. I'll be waiting.
I don't have a deadline.
Well, tonight on The Breakdown, a special guest. She is regularly vilified by Republicans, but she's one of Democrats' most prolific fundraisers and lawmakers.
That's right, and we're talking about the once and maybe future Speaker of the House, San Francisco Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. The House Minority Leader for the time is back in town for a few days, and she stopped by KQED for a rather long chat with us.
Yeah, you hear that, Difi and Kamala? The Minority Leader was here.
She was waiting for you.
We'll get our senators on The Breakdown soon enough. But first, it was an auspicious week to get her in here because there was a lot of crazy news, and most of it centered, of course, around criminal cases related to President Trump, his campaign, former campaign staff, his former lawyer.
Yeah, and someone else connected to the president, Southern California Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter. We thought that was a safe Republican district down there in San Diego, but it may not be. A 47-page indictment this week, alleging that he and his wife misused some $250,000 in campaign funds.
Some crazy details in there around
rabbits,
$14,000 trips
balls
to Italy, and claiming to their own treasurer on that campaign that it was actually for charity. And we're going to ask Pelosi about that. So let's get right to it.
We're going to go to our interview with House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. And can we just say, she had some pink shoes on.
She had some great shoes. I covet her wardrobe. That is not a political statement. It's all fashion.
All right, let's get to it. Here's the interview. Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, thank you so much for joining us on Political Breakdown.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, a lot going on this week, sort of tsunami, earthquake, hurricane in D.C., whatever disaster you want to describe it as. Paul Manafort found guilty on 8 counts, tax and bank fraud. Michael Cohen also pleading guilty. What is the takeaway for you? Like, what do you think is the most important thing to take away from all this?
President Trump has engendered a culture of corruption, cronyism, and incompetence. We see it, and also that is in the Congress as well. The first person to endorse President Trump, Congressman Collins, has been indicted for insider trading or issues related to that. Now the second person to endorse President Trump, Duncan Hunter of California, has been indicted for embezzlement. But this culture of corruption, the president, he hijacked our name. And we said drain the swamp in 06 when we won the election because it was rampant among the Republicans, their culture of corruption, cronyism, incompetence. He stole our title. He hijacked our title but betrayed our mission. And it's just made matters worse.
What we keep hearing, though, is that the base doesn't care that much. And I'm curious just like what your message is going to be moving forward on this, because it seems like, you know, he's going to hit this issue that this isn't about Russia, this isn't about me, over and over again.
Well, it is true that people are concerned about what affects their lives. So what we are saying, what I'm saying to members today in a communication is, all this is our responsibility to keep government honest and working for people. But what's important is that working for people. We have a better deal, which is, who are Democrats for? Democrats are for the people.
Are you saying
lowering health care costs, increasing their paycheck, and honesty in government?
Are you saying that Democrats running for election, re-election this year shouldn't really be focusing on Donald Trump?
Oh, I don't think they should even mention his name. He's self-evidently what he is. But what they have to do is connect with it's about themselves. People want to know, how do you relate to my hopes and fears, aspirations, and apprehensions? And so what is the big issues out there now are health care costs, not having more purchasing power in their paychecks, even though people are telling them everything's so great,
right,
as well as corruption in government. They know that big money, big dark money in politics is one of the reasons we can't lower cost of prescription drugs, why we can't increase the minimum wage, because those forces are so at work. So the connection between lowering cost, increasing pay, and honesty in government is a very direct one. So you're right. In terms of Russia across the country, people are like, well, deal with it. But what I want to know is how you're going to help me.
Well, we're going to take a short break and then get back to our interview with House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer, and we're going to jump back into our interview with House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Well, we want to talk about you, too, okay. And about kind of your history in politics. You know, you grew up in a really political family in
yes.
Baltimore. Your dad was mayor. Your brother was mayor. Your dad was a congressman as well. And when we were thinking about this, we're curious kind of like what you learned from them, especially when it comes to the attacks we see on you by Republicans very often.
Yeah.
Do you think you learned some thick skin and lessons from watching them?
And how to punch back.
Well, as I always say to the candidates, you have to know how to take a punch and throw a punch. No, I mean, what we learned growing up, I never intended to run for office ever. So that was something that happened later for me after my children were bigger. But the thing is that we were instilled with the idea that public service was a noble calling and to respect all those who engaged in it because we all have a responsibility to each other. That was engendered. And the Democrats and Republicans in those days fought because we had different philosophy, mm-hmm. but they had different philosophy. I said we, the adults, but there were personal friendships. It wasn't the way it is now, the politics of personal destruction. And so you would learn to respect other people's views, to have the humility to respect other people's views. And so that's what I learned, and that's what, but I also learned how to count votes.
I think you were called Little Nancy when you were a little girl, and there's a picture in your office of you and President Kennedy when you were how old?
A teenager, 16,
yeah. But I'm wondering, you know, back to what Marisa said, your dad must have been attacked while he was in
all
politics.
The time.
And so as his daughter, what was that like for you? And what did you take away from that other than how to count votes?
Well, it just goes with the territory. Yeah, as President Truman is famous for saying in history, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. This is the arena. You decide to enter the arena. And you decide that you're going to make decisions to advance public policy, to improve the lives of people. And there are other people who are agents of the status quo who will oppose that. But this is what it is. If you can't take it, then don't do it.
Just one quick question. You get criticized for a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And I won't list the litany, but are there things that you think, that's really not fair versus, there's some truth in that.
I don't think any of them. I think everything is fair game. I don't pay that much attention to it. But the fact is that they go after you if you're effective. And that's what I did learn growing up. If you're not effective, they don't even care what you do. But I'm effective. Master legislator, says she immodestly, and I say this because I want women to hear me assert myself because I want them to assert themselves, and women sometimes hesitate to do that. I may be respected as a master legislator, and I love being a legislator. I'm effective in terms of raising money more than anybody who hasn't run for president of the United States.
$660 million.
But they have to undo me. You know, in other words, in their fundraising letters, they say we have to stop her because she attracts so much money. And why do I? Because I'm effective and because I have a plan. I have values, a vision for our future, a plan to get it done, and a plan to win. So they have to stop that. So I take it, if I were not effective, they wouldn't be coming at me. I know when I was sworn in as speaker and I had the children around me, it was quite a moment. But people said to me after, you've just made yourself a great big target for the Republicans because they have to take you down. And so, that's the way it is.
So you said a moment ago you never thought you'd run for office.
No.
And I know you were very involved in Democratic politics in California
mm-hmm.
before you did. Mm-hmm. Did someone ask you to run? Because we hear a lot women need to be asked.
Yeah, I did. Congresswoman Sala Burton asked me to run. And I really had never. I loved promoting other people. I was chair of the California Democratic Party, northern chair, state chair. That I loved that promoting other people, shared values about all of the things we want to advancing equality in every way in our society, as well as protecting our environment and a fair economy, all the E's, education and the rest. But then Congresswoman Sala Burton, unbeknownst to me in terms of the seriousness of her illness, was very ill. And she said to me, you have to come see me. I want you. But she said, I don't want you to run for mayor. I know everybody wants you to run for mayor. I was like, I'm not running for mayor. I grew up in that atmosphere. It's wonderful, but I'll leave that for others. And then she said, but you should run. You love the issues. You should be in Congress. And I, you know, hesitated because I had never, I never planned to run.
Never went through your mind.
Never went through my mind. Oh, I had been asked before to run for office, but I completely rejected it because when I was asked before, I had like five teenagers. And I said, you must be kidding. I have five teenagers. Why would I run for office? At that time, I was chair of the California Democratic Party. That's a volunteer.
What office did they want you to run for?
Well, we won't go into that. Right.
Okay.
But when it came time, when the Congress, I did go to my youngest child, Alexandra, who was going to be a senior in high school. I said, Alexandra, mommy's been asked to run for Congress. It would be better if it were one more year when you would be in college. Any answer is fine. I love my life. I love being here with you. But I'd be gone like three nights a week for a certain number of months. If I won, I don't even know if I'll win. I'm just going to run. But I won't do it if you want me to be here with you. To which she said, and this is 30 years ago, Mother, not Mommy, Mother, get a life.
What a teenage answer.
Yeah, I know,
you.
But I had never heard the expression. You have to understand, that's common talk now, but then it was, get a life.
Do you think they ever regretted? Did you think she ever regretted that?
No, what she then said was, what teenage girl wouldn't want her mother out of the house three nights a week? So, no, she didn't get it. But, no, I don't think so. But she herself she loved radio. What I later learned is that she was sneaking out at night to do the nighttime shift, whatever you call it.
Late overnight.
At USF, because they had a great radio
KUSF.
Station.
How funny. Yeah. I want to ask you a question about your faith, because you're a devout Catholic, I think. Is that fair to say?
True.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And how often do you go to Mass?
Regularly. I go every week.
Every week. So how do you...
At least every week.
How do you negotiate the positions of the church on things like gay marriage, gay rights, on the death penalty, although the Pope now has said the death penalty is wrong. But, you know, there are a lot of issues that you and many other Democrats espouse that are in conflict with the church. How do you deal with that?
Well, it's not in conflict with my conscience and as well as how I was raised as a Catholic. I was raised as an Italian-American community in Baltimore, Maryland, in Little Italy, in an enclave there. And we were taught that every person was really important. So from the standpoint of LGBTQ issues, that was how we were raised. It was never anything different than we respect people for who they are.
But as you know, the church has, in the past, gone after people like John Kerry, you know, because they were pro-choice.
Right. Pro-choice is another issue. I do believe that, and this is not a view that is universally shared in my own family. They're not rabid pro-life, but they are more in the pro-life position. So I understand that we have a difference of opinion. But I do believe that God has given us all a free will and given us a responsibility to live accordingly and honor our responsibilities. And I do believe as a mother of five, I have five children. When Alexandra came home from the hospital that week, my oldest child was turning six. So, I'm with the program, but that doesn't mean other people have to be with the program. You know what I'm saying? It's like I said to my colleagues, any one of you has had five children in 6 years, let's have a conversation about contraception, birth control, Planned Parenthood, and the rest.
So, five kids under the age of six.
Oh, six and under.
Six and under. You talked earlier about that you are effective and sort of the things you do, which include raising money and passing legislation. I guess first I'm curious of having those kids and having that experience you think has helped you
in
Congress.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, I'll tell you. Let's hear it for parents. Having a family is a wonderful thing. It is also a challenge, right? You have to be masters of how you manage time, personalities, responsibilities, and the rest. And when you raise five children under six and under in that period of time, when they are all in school all day, you think you can do anything. You know, and it's like, bring it on from 8:30 to 3:30. Bring it on. And because you have been so energized by your responsibility, there is no room for error.
Right. You know, is that similar, being a leader? I mean, because I want to hear you talk about, like, what do you bring to that? There's a lot of talk about whether it's time for new leadership. And I think you've said right here that you feel like you're very good at your job.
Yes.
What is that job?
Well, here's what I consider. As I said, as a master legislator, I consider myself sort of a weaver. I'm like at a loom, and I have all these beautiful threads that come together, some very different under the tent of the diversity of the Democratic Party. And what I need to do is to make sure that every thread is in the fabric of what we are putting together without any this is better than that or anything like that. So I consider myself being at a loom, working with my colleagues to design what this tapestry will be. And that is what the unity is in our, when we win all of these votes, people say, how do you keep them together? I said, I don't. Our shared values keep us together because we weave all of this together.
I just want to say, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, along with Marisa Lagos. We're talking with House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Keeping the caucus together. Give some specifics, because, boy, you've got some diverse characters out there, and there's some people running for office that would even diversify that further. Give us some specifics. What do you do to keep that loyalty and to keep people together?
Well, first let me just brag that our caucus is over 50% women, people of color, and LGBTQ community members. And that makes us historic in the history of the world. A political party has not had that kind of diversity. And it will even be more numbers in all of those categories when we win in November, which we intend to do. The so we have diversity of generation, of geography, of ethnicity, of gender identity, you name it. We have this beautiful diversity. And we have a lot of respect for everybody's perspective as to what their priorities are. So we build by consensus. I don't come in with a piece of paper and say, here's what it is, everybody sign up. This is the challenge. These are the possibilities. We're not going to the lowest common denominator. We're going to the boldest common denominator. And when we make those decisions, people just stay on board, like 100% voting against the unfair tax bill that gives 83% of the benefits to the top 1%. In some people's districts, that was presented in a way that might sound appealing.
Is it personal relationships with them? Like,
well, yeah, you have to understand people's motivation, their district, their priorities, and how. Again, though, everybody's in the discussion, in the consensus. Affordable Care Act, Dodd-Frank, the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, to stimulus package, just the list goes on of things where we're together.
As you know, there is challenge to your leadership. You're the minority leader now, and there are people running for office who are promising not to vote for you for speaker. And I know you said, do what you need to do to
win.
That's
right.
Yeah. But come December, January, when, if you win back the House. When you win back the House, if you win, do you just say to those folks, okay, now let's get real. I'm the best person. What do you do?
Well, I will say I'm the best person. None of us is indispensable. We know that. But I do think, by dint of my experience, because in addition to not ever wanting to run for think about running for Congress, I never was running for leadership. Other people came to me and said, you must run for leadership. And when I did run for a high office and leadership, some of the men said, who said she could run? Well, that just lit my fire, really. Who said she could run? We don't need permission. Well, they had a pecking order from 200 years or so of people who would always be next.
But isn't that kind of what the younger people are criticizing?
Yeah, no, but I wouldn't, let me just take issue with that for a moment. I've always had an opponent. I don't think I've ever had, maybe the first time I ran for speaker because I just delivered the majority. Maybe then I wasn't opposed, but I've always been opposed. So that is that goes with the territory. It's a different point of view. People, it's just natural. I don't even consider it unusual. But the fact is that I believe I would have walked away from all of this. Anybody who lives in San Francisco doesn't like to get on a plane every week to go to Washington, D.C., that's for sure. But if Hillary had won, I know how important it is to have a woman at the table. I mean, just you cannot just have five people who look very much the same at the table and think that people are going to say, oh, my views are represented there. So when we had President Obama, we had that diversity, and I as a woman as speaker, and then when Hillary... If she had won, I knew that the Affordable Care Act would be protected. And I feel very proprietary about the Affordable Care Act, as you can imagine. But she didn't win. And so I thought, okay, I have to give this, I'll stay to make this fight to protect the Affordable Care Act, which I know chapter and verse, what's good about it and what needs to be improved about it, and how to fight them off, as well as being at the table. So when we come back, when we win, I will be up to the caucus. But that's how it is. The caucus votes to send a name to the floor. But I certainly will have my name in contention.
It seems like your rhetoric around this question has changed slightly. I've heard you talk about building a bridge and that somebody
has to...
We
have to build a bridge to the future. And that's what we were saying to people. If you want to be the other side of the bridge, get a following.
Show me what you got.
Show me.
So a following. And I don't think that I should be the leader or the speaker or whatever because of what I've done, but what I'm capable of doing into the future in terms of the issues that we want, lower prices, bigger paychecks, and a cleaner government. And I know as an appropriator, I know the budget cold because, again, I was doing my work. I wasn't running for leadership then. And I'm I'm the first leader, I think, on either side, going back, way back, that had national security credential. I'm the longest serving intelligence person, and they have politicized it. So I think that in addition to protecting and advancing our causes, we have to restore nonpartisanship to our security.
A lot of people would like to be speaker. Some people think they should be or could be speaker. Mm-hmm. What do you think they don't know about being speaker?
Well, I don't know. I mean, everybody brings their own whatever they have to the table. I think that people right now are trying to say when this happens, and there will be a transition, when this happens, we want to be considered. But again, you have to really, you have your vision that you share with your, springing from your, what is your vision? What is your knowledge? What is your strategic thinking about how to get something done? And how do you lead? Bring people together around that.
So the point about just not having a speaker or a minority leader who's a target,
always be a target. I remember when I was chair of the California Democratic Party, the ads they took out against Tip O'Neill. I wish I had them.
But we don't see this attack from the Democrats, say, on Mitch McConnell.
Well, you don't see it from the press. I mean, the press is, you know, the Mitch McConnell has been there a long time. I don't know.
Do you think it has to do with your gender?
There are some people who think that it's misogyny. But
what do you think?
Well, I think that it's because I'm effective. If you saw their fundraising letters, they're like, she is outraising us. She's just a powerful fundraiser. We have to stop her. But they're really more concerned about me being across the table from them because I eat their lunch in every negotiation. It took them five... what we call continuing resolutions to realize that they were going to have to agree with us on how we made major investments in our domestic budget in addition to what they wanted to do with the defense budget. Five, from end of September until the spring when they finally realized we might as well give up. So where we have leverage, and especially when it comes to budget, because I'm an appropriator, I know that territory very well. We have not been in the ad hominem business of attacking people. We rather talk about what we will do to improve people's lives. But the fact is that you don't even hear the press asking Mitch McConnell, much less the Democrats challenging him on this.
So closer to home, there are 7 to 10 congressional districts in California that Democrats are going for. You sound pretty confident that Democrats can take back the House. You mentioned Duncan Hunter earlier being indicted down in Southern California. I guess just like curious, what when you look at the math in California, how optimistic are you about those districts and that one, which some people think he could still win? Even
I completely agree. You know, it's such a Republican district that they that who knows, they may just say, you know, whatever happens to him, we want to vote for a Republican now.
So dead man walking.
Okay, let me just say this. When I first, when people suggested I run for leadership, I said, well, I won't do it, but I want to win. And so when I made my first announcement that I was running, at that time, we had 26 Democrats and 26 Republicans in California out of 52. We now have 53 because we picked up one in reapportionment. 26. I said to them, let me show my leadership. I will run what we do in California. After that 2000 election, we had 31-21. We picked up 10. Now, do you know what we have? 39-14. So we have milked California pretty well in terms of the enthusiasm for equal rights and environment and all the rest. And we still think we can win more seats.
I want to transition. We're almost out of time from milk to milk chocolate. I've been to your office a couple times, several times in D.C. There's always all these jars of Ghirardelli chocolate. What is it about chocolate?
It's not milk, though, for me.
Dark chocolate. The dark chocolate.
Really dark. And the darker,
the better.
I
needed the metaphor.
I agree with you.
I got your transition. Now let's transition.
My segue.
It's very dark.
Be accurate, Scott.
Yeah, it's very good for you. I heard once on the radio years ago, since we were on the radio, that eating chocolate was good for your teeth. I immediately changed the station so that I didn't have to hear any counter argument to that. And, you know, I don't know. I just have all my whole life since a little girl love chocolate. And it is, you know, so when people say, how do you have all this energy? You're on the floor for 8 hours, you know, this and that and high heel shoes and this or that. I said, I think it's having raised a family, so you're in high gear all the time, right? I think it's being Italian-American. I just have this boundless energy within me. Dark chocolate.
Were you eating chocolate?
Dark chocolate.
During that filibuster, were you eating chocolate?
No, I was. No, I was just drinking water.
Yeah. Well, on that note,
they did give me candy. Some people passed candy, but they were more. They weren't.
It wasn't chocolate.
More chocolate.
Yeah. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you. Just such an honor to be here, but also to represent this golden state of California, heaven on earth.
Well, that does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio.
You can check us out anytime on all of our past episodes at Apple Podcasts. You can also rate, review, and subscribe to The Breakdown there.
And our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineers this week are Howard Gelman and Rob Spate.
Ethan Lindsay is our managing editor, and Holly Kernan is our vice president of news. I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter and some pictures of those shoes at mlagos.
I'm looking for those. I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. It's at Scott Schaefer. That is a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. We'll see you next time, everybody.